Hello and welcome to episode 23 of Two Chairs Talking, a podcast which is hosted by myself, David Grigg, and my co-host, as always, Perry Middlemiss. How's things, Perry?
G'day, David. Pretty well, thanks. I'm not doing too badly. I haven't got any sore throat, haven't got any problems with anything that might be considered to be a virus.
Yes, so that's good. We should, for the sake of future listeners to this podcast, we should say that we're recording this at the beginning of March in 2020. And of course, everyone at the moment is very worried about the prospect of a pandemic with this new virus that's going around. So we're trying to keep our chins up, and we're thinking about, we thought we might actually recommend books to you that you might be reading if you have to isolate yourself from the community for a while. So it's always a good way to have a stack of really good books to read your way through when you have to be at home. So
excellent idea.
So Perry, what have you been reading? I've got a number of books I want to talk about, but you want to start?
Well, a couple of things I want to get to first. One listener contacted me and said that he was a bit confused about how I went about giving my ratings on books. So just a brief discussion about how I go about doing that and basically how that's changed over the last year or so. You and I, David, are members and followers of a website called goodreads.com,
yep,
which we can recommend, and we should actually talk about at some point.
Sure.
But we can actually recommend this website for people. It allows you to keep track of your reading, to put down books that you want to read, those that you have read in the past, and to keep track of what your friends are reading. I think that David likes this so that he can keep track of me, so that he knows that I'm keeping up with the reading list that he gives me for this particular podcast, to make sure that I'm not slacking off when it comes to doing all of the reading for the Hugo Awards that we did a couple of weeks ago.
What it lets me do is see some of the strange books that you're reading, which I've never heard of. So that's quite useful.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that is a good point about it, you see, because you're starting to see other people looking at things and you're starting to get a bit of an idea about what they think of them. Mm. Now, when you actually finish your book on Goodreads, not only do you say when you finish reading it, you can also write a review if that's what you want to do. You don't have to. And you can also give it a ranking out of 5 stars. That's basically the way that I've been doing things in the past, but I've come to the realization that it's all about rounding. And so a book that you might think you would give just a touch over 3.5 stars, and a book that you might give just a touch under 4.5, actually both get 4 stars.
Yeah.
Which strikes me as being, you know, too wide a range, basically, because I see there's a big gap between a 3.6 and a 4.4 book, if you want to put it that way. I don't give books rankings of 0 or 1, just personal preference. I think that if somebody's gone to the effort of actually having written a bloody thing, that I should actually give it a bit of time and acknowledge the fact that they have done so. Probably silly, but that's just me.
No.
Lowest I've given a book is 2, and I, at some stage or other I'll go back and have a look and work out which ones they are. I know one of them was Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov.
Yeah.
Didn't like that one at all for various numbers of reasons. And I have given a number of 5s. Now, they aren't necessarily always exactly 5.
No.
And so to give you an example, a couple of episodes ago, we were talking about the 1961 Hugo Awards. We spoke about A Canticle for Leibowitz, classic in the field. I actually gave that about 4.8.
Mm-hmm.
Why it's 4.8 and not 5? Don't know. Basically, that's just personal preference. And so that would have been rounded up to 5, and I was quite happy on the Goodreads scale to give that a 5-star rating. Yep. Absolutely no problems whatsoever. So that's basically the way that I go about doing it. I'm not sure how you work it, David. Do you do something similar, or just go to whole numbers?
Yeah, I think I do. What I do is I keep a spreadsheet. I've started to keep a spreadsheet anyway
of what
I've been reading. And in there I do put decimal points, because if you've got two books and you really do feel one is a bit better than the other, and you've given them just a 5-star rate, both as 5-star rating, how do you distinguish between them? So I nudge it down to 4.8 or 4.9 or whatever it is to sort of jiggle the order of things, and that sort of ends up giving me a rating. And I was thinking in that context that I've been raving recently about the author Claire North. And I gave both of the books I've read of hers last year a rating of 5 on Goodreads. But there are subtle differences in them. And I've just read a third book of hers, which I might talk about in a little bit. And that doesn't go quite as much. So maybe I would say that the best book of hers I read, which was The Sudden Appearance of Hope, I'd give that 4.9. The next one I would give, I'd probably give 4.8 to first 15 Lives of Harry August. And I'd probably give 4.5 to the one I've read most recently, which is called Touch, which I can talk about now, or we can talk about later, however you prefer, Perry.
4.5 is still a pretty high score.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's still a very good book. Everything she writes is terrific that I've read so far. So I haven't had any disappointments so far, but this isn't quite as good as the other. So that's why the ratings like that, decimal ratings, are quite useful.
Well, it's also a point that if you keep track of everything on a spreadsheet, as we will do, or we are doing, it allows us then at the end of the year for us to go back just over the spreadsheet and have a look at it and not have to think, oh, now, I read that book in January. What the hell was it about again?
Yes, that's right.
Did I actually like that book? Maybe I better go back and skim over it again. This way, at least, if you've already got a rating in your spreadsheet and you've put it down, then we can basically go back at the end of the year and pick the top 5 and go, okay, here we go. Yep. Absolutely no problems.
Yeah.
And I think that just makes things a lot easier for us. Yep. Now, I know that's, to a lot of people, this sounds fairly nerdy and a really detailed way of going about doing things, but hey, I've got time. It takes me 15 seconds to actually type the stuff out into the spreadsheet and then put a rating on it and then allow my spreadsheet to just ripple through and work out everything that it's going to do.
Yep.
Oh, it reminds me, I should put a formula in to rank them all. That's a good idea. I'll fix that one up later.
Okay.
Just basically messing about with that. And so this then gives us an opportunity, I believe, to be able to get a better view in our own heads about where these books rank in our own minds.
Yeah.
I think it's a fairly useful thing.
Yeah,
I agree. So, Claire North.
Yeah, Touch. So this is another one of her books where she comes up with a very clever little concept and then just plumbs the depths of it and keeps going and then turns it into a thriller. This one is much more of a thriller, I would say, than the other two books I've talked about. And so in Touch, the first-person protagonist is what the author calls a ghost, or she herself, the protagonist, describes herself as a ghost. So, but bear with us on that. What it means is that she can transfer her whole identity, her soul, if you like, into another human being, so long as she's able to touch their skin. And once she's transferred, she's completely in control of that person's body. And when she leaves, the original person returns, but with a big gap in their memory. They've got no memory of what's gone on while this protagonist has been inside their mind. So it has more of a thriller emphasis, as I say. In fact, it actually starts with the current host, because she calls the people she's inside her host. So she's it actually starts with her current host being shot to death, shot dead by an assassin at a train station, underground train station. And she escapes this host is dying. She escapes by managing to touch someone else in the crowd and transferring to them. And then someone else, because the assassin is tracking her and can sense one way or another that she's actually moved from one body to the other. And so it's a very exciting start to the story. And it goes on from there. We never find out the protagonist's real name, or even quite exactly when she was born, although I think eventually we discover it's in the late 1700s when she was originally born. But she's been moving from host to host to host. And, of course, that means she never actually dies. But she can die if someone kills the host that she's in and she doesn't get the chance to get out of it. So we never actually find out her real name, but there's a group which is hunting her down, her and others like her, because there are more than one of her. there's a group that's trying to hunt her down, and they call her Kepler, as in the scientist Kepler. But there's also a ghost they tag as Galileo, who it turns out is no ally of Kepler, but has his or her, because with the gender, of course, changes with the host that they're in, has their own agenda. So it's another great concept, really, really gripping sort of story, pulls you in and takes you through. But I say, well, just wasn't quite up to the other two books of hers I've read, but still pretty damn good. So yeah, I would give that a 4.5.
So when was that one written?
I can't tell you. I think it was probably in between the Harry August book and Sudden Appearance of Hope. But if you will give me a moment or two, I'll look it up on Wikipedia.
I've been reading a fair bit lately, leading up to the nominations for the Hugo Awards. These are the ones that are going to be held this year in New Zealand. Now, regardless of whatever happens with the pandemic and the coronavirus, the Hugo Awards will still go ahead, because that is one of the major things that a Worldcon has to do. It really only has to do three things, but it's the gathering of the clans all in one place, which is the fun part of things. And if it doesn't go ahead, we'll be vastly disappointed. But anyway, I've been doing a bit of reading for that, and I've read a couple of debut novels from 2019, which I wanted to have a talk about. The first one of these is called A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martin. Now, Martin, I'd never heard of prior to this particular book, but it started picking up a few good reviews, and I thought I'd better have a look at it. And then it got nominated for the Nebula Award. Now, you might recall that the Hugo Awards are reader-voted awards, whereas the Nebula Awards are those given out by the science fiction writers of America. Well, it's actually the science fiction and fantasy writers of America, but they're still called the SFWA. They make recommendations during the year, during the particular calendar year, for books that they have read. And all of those recommendations at the end of the year are collated by the SFWA committee and put up as a ballot, which is then jury judged. So it's not judged on the popular vote amongst the membership of SFWA. Anyway, A Memory Called Empire, up for a Nebula Award. Now, Martin's written about a dozen short SF works. So this is the good thing about science fiction to me, because a lot of people start off not writing a novel first. They write a lot of short fiction first. It then builds up until they feel they have their technique in place, they have their voice, and then they kick off and then go into a novel. Doesn't always work, but the SF field allows for an apprenticeship to build up. So by the time you get to a debut novel, if you've seen that an author has 10, 12, 15 short pieces already published, you know they've got a bit of a track record, and you know that they are not just a starting out author. They may have been around for 3, 4, 5 years, maybe 10, before they get going. Anyway, this particular novel is really quite good. It's set in a galactic empire. We don't know whether this is a human empire, but we've sort of got to assume that the people that are inhabiting it are all of the one race, and they seem to be humanoid. Doesn't matter if they are, doesn't matter if it are, doesn't. They could be any shape. They could be a blob for all I care, because I'm really not really overly fussed about it. Now, one of the problems I have sometimes with some SF authors is they come up with names that I basically bloody can't pronounce. So this is set in an empire, which is called the Texcalan. Yeah, that'll do. That's close enough. Texcalan Empire. This has a home world run by an emperor, and a whole lot of the other worlds that are incorporated into that empire send ambassadors to the home world as a means of basically the same way that you would with the United Nations. It's basically, although in this case the emperor runs the whole of the Galactic Empire, the ambassadors are there to basically give information to and from each of the nations. Now, the main character of this particular book, A Memory Called Empire, is Ambassador Mahet Zima. Oh God, I could give them problems again. She comes from a mining station, which is a very small clustering of stations in orbit around a particular planet. This particular planet has a whole lot of minerals that the Empire wants for its technology. And it also happens to be near and protecting two particular gateways. We always have the problem with galactic empires in that how do you get from one side of the universe to the other, or one side of the galaxy to the other, without taking hundreds of years? The conceit in this instance is to have wormholes, basically. So you fly through a wormhole, pop out the other end an hour or two later, and there you are, you've crossed half the galaxy. We all know this is theoretically impossible, but in order for the whole of the structure of the novel to work, you pretty much have to accept that and just move on. It's a fairly standard trope inside science fiction, so we just go with it. Now, anyway, this ambassador is appointed to the Empire because the Empire sent a ship to the mining station and said, we need an ambassador. But hang on a minute, we've already got one there. Nothing was said about the previous ambassador. So she is appointed because she's done a very large amount of work from a very small station on the Empire itself, knows how to speak the court's language, knows a lot about the history, the poetry and the literature, and so she's the best choice to go along. She's quite young, but she's been studying it all this time. So she goes and finds out that the previous ambassador is dead. He's died under fairly weird and exceptional circumstances, and nobody seems to basically want to tell her what happened. So she has to try and find out. Added to this, this particular mining station, because it has a very small population, has developed a brainstem technology which allows each person to be able to record their personal experiences into a memory chip, which they then download, which when they die can be passed on to the next person that takes on their role. This basically means that instead of having a large number of people with certain amounts of experience, like being a pilot or being a miner or an engineer, you actually have a smaller group because you just don't have enough people, but they all have the same information from the experience from 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 other people that will go down the line. Now, this, if you think about it, really gives you the indication that possibly it is a chance to almost be immortal, because your personality is going to carry on into the next person, almost like
very much host, like the same thing.
And so you can see similarities between these two particular stories, although they're not talking to each other at all. I wouldn't have thought that these were written with anything in common. It just happens to be one of those coincidences that pops up.
Sure.
So anyway, the Emperor of this Galactic Empire is getting old and he's dying, but he hasn't actually named a successor as yet. And as the book continues on, and the new ambassador suddenly comes to realise that this secret technology may now no longer be all that secret, and maybe the Emperor is trying to negotiate to get this technology in order to continue his reign, because he now has a 10-year-old clone. Mm. But the interesting thing is the ambassador has not been heard of for 10 years.
Mm.
So there's a very funny thing going on here. This is really well-handled book.
Mm.
It's basically almost a murder mystery being run by the ambassador trying to solve who killed the previous ambassador, because it's pretty obvious he was killed. What relationships he was having in the court and what he was doing, and how this is going to impact her whole nation, her whole people. Because if the Empire decides they just want to take over this mining station, they'll just move in and impose martial law, and that'll be it. They'll basically clean everybody out and take the whole lot. So somehow the previous ambassador has trod a very tightrope to make sure that he's been able to maintain the independence of the station while also getting exactly what he thinks they want. So it's an excellent book. I gave it 4.6, mm-hmm. So it's pretty high for me, which would round it up to a 5. And I also nominated it for my Hugo Award ballot for this year.
Very good.
A recommendation, David.
Excellent, excellent. That's excellent. Just while we're talking about Hugo Awards and nominations and so on, last year you talked about the book Infinite Detail by Tim Maugham. And so I actually read that myself this year, and I agree with you that it would be great to see it nominated, but I don't it wasn't even on the Locus Awards list of potential award winners, as far as I can see. But I really enjoyed it. It's the basic idea, as Perry mentioned last time, is that it's a future in which the internet has been attacked and is utterly broken, and basically society collapses as a result of that. So I thought it was very well done, and I agree with you. It was still definitely a candidate for an award. Should get some sort of award for sure. Maybe the BSFA award. Maybe
I've nominated it for the Hugo as well.
Yeah.
So I only put three novel nominees in this year. You're allowed up to five, but I only put three in. Memory Called Empire was one. Infinite Detail was another one, and another book in a minute of mine is also on the list. Mm.
Okay, I've got a few books I want to cover, so we'll see how we go tick-tocking backwards and forwards. I read a couple of crime novels this year. One was called The Wicked Girls by Alex Marwood. And the reason I picked up this writer was that I read an interview with Stephen King, the horror writer, in which he nominated Alex Marwood as one of a number of people that he would be really pleased to have a writing collaboration with. And I'd never heard of this author before, so I was intrigued, and so I went hunting. So it turns out that Alex Marwood is the pseudonym of Sinina Maxey, who's a columnist for the Independent newspaper in the UK. And she wrote a series of novels under her own name before adopting Alex Marwood as her alias for writing thrillers. And so The Wicked Girls is her first such thriller, which was published in 2012. And the story turns around two British women who we discover were involved in the death of a small child when they were just preteen girls. And they were charged at the time with her murder and placed in juvenile correctional facilities. And the case, obviously, because the girls were so young, was notorious, and the two girls were universally vilified. Now, when the book starts, they've grown up into adults and they've changed their names. And, of course, they dread the thought of being identified as one of these girls who were involved in this incident some years before. So the details of what actually happened to this younger girl who died only slowly emerge as a series of flashbacks as the book progresses. But the foreground story, as it were, the present-day story, is a small seaside town in Britain, and there's a serial killer who is targeting young women in this kind of declining seaside town. And one of the two main characters, one of these two women who were the girls in this original incident, works in a fun fair in the town. If you think of somewhere like Luna Park in Australia, that kind of place. And the other is a journalist based in London who's been sent up to this town to report on the serial killer. But neither of them knows about the other person being in the town and what their new identity is. But of course, eventually, as the story progresses, they do come into contact and recognize each other. And then their involvement with this serial killer becomes more intense, and secrets from the past begin to be revealed. It's pretty good stuff. I thought it was very well done, but wasn't quite sure of how the way it ended. But still, I'm going to try some more of her books. So that was that one. And just very briefly, since I'm talking about crime, I also read The Mermaid's Singing by Val McDermid. He was a pretty well-known crime writer. And this is the first of a series of stories, books. I think Tony Hill and Carol Jordan are the two protagonists in those books. It eventually ended up as a TV series called Wire in the Blood. But this book, The Mermaid Singing, is the very first of these books. And it opens in a pretty disturbing way with what purports to be the extracts from a digital diary by the killer. And in the very first entry, he visits the torture museum in San Gimignano. This is actually a real place, by the way. And he gets very excited by what he sees in this torture museum. And then later we find out that he's been building his own versions of these machines to use on his victims. So it's pretty gruesome. But anyway, I won't talk at any great length about it, but it wasn't bad, but I didn't quite like the ending. Was meant to be a sort of surprise twist as to who the killer actually is, and it, to me, it didn't work because I actually saw it coming a fair way in advance. So yeah, it was okay. I'm not totally rushing out to read other books in that series. So that's my crime reading for the year, Perry. How about you?
Next one I've got is another science fiction novel, again another Nebula nominee, and another debut from 2019. Uh-huh. So it's interesting that two of the ones I've picked this today are debut novels. Now, this is by a woman called Alexi Harrow. She's written about six short SF pieces previously, one of which, A Witch's Guide to Escape, won the Hugo Award last year in 2019. It was handed out in Dublin. This particular book has been getting quite a lot of good and favourable reviews. It follows two particular timelines. The first of this is follows a young woman in the early 1900s in the American South, living in a in an old house with her maiden aunts. All the males seem to have died off. And she's out walking one day in the block next door and walks towards a derelict house when a man steps through a door. Now, the interesting thing about that is there's nothing behind that door.
Mm-hmm.
And he steps through and she gets a glimpse of something through the door before he closes it. And then she starts talking to him and she realises that he has a very strange accent. He looks very peculiar. And he talks to her for an hour or two and then has to leave. And he goes back through the door. And when she tries to go through it, there's nothing there. Interesting.
Hmm.
Then the second timeline that we're talking about follows some years later in a sort of similar area, maybe in the American South again, but probably 20, 30 years later. We're talking about a... following the life of January Scalar. So this is the January of the title, the 10,000 Doors of January. She lives as the ward of a wealthy man, Mr. Locke. Mr. Locke is employing her father to scour the world, finding treasures all over the world to put into his collection, because he's one of these guys that has huge amounts of money, lots of time on his hands, and he likes to have his friends around and show them all these weird things that he's collected from around the world, you know, sort of face masks from Papua New Guinea or baubles from the Middle East and all that sort of stuff. So January's father is always continually away. The mother, there's no mother around at all, but January's father floats off and then he goes missing. Nobody hears from him for ages. And nobody knows what's going on. But he occasionally, when he comes back, he leaves things around for January. And one of the things he's left is a sort of stuff in a chest. So she goes through one day, starting digging through this, and she pulls a book out and starts reading this book that he's left there for her. And you, as the reader, start to realise that the book tells the story of the woman that we met at the very beginning of the book.
Mm.
And it follows that. She then starts to realise that there's something funny here with these doors. And she starts to follow, she starts to get the feeling that she can identify where the doors are when she feels something when she walks near one. And she basically takes off one day to try and find a father, thinking that maybe he's gone through these doors as well and that he's got lost somewhere. Now, these doors are basically, again, it's just like teleportation devices. You open the door, it's a portal. It takes you to a completely different world. And, you remember The Big Front Yard?
Yes.
By Clifford Simak? Yep. Same sort of idea.
Yeah.
Where basically you step through a door and you're in a completely and utterly different world. And then to move on to the next place, you have to find the next door and so on and so forth. And she does this and goes through it. But during her travels, while she's out looking for her father and trying to work out what's going on, as she continually, when she gets time, she reads another chapter of the book. So you get a little bit more of the first woman's story. She suddenly starts to realise that the doors are being destroyed behind her. Now, you as a reader figure out much earlier than she does what's going on and how these two timelines are going to interconnect. I didn't find that to be a derogatory point of the book. I thought she handled this very well. It's a moving emotional book where things come together and those two timelines slowly start connecting and joining up. And I thought it was very well done, a very accomplished debut. And again, Nebula nominee, and also one that I put onto my Hugo ballot.
Sounds good.
Yep. Recommend it. Gave it 4.6. And when I have a look at it this morning, because I wrote these on two separate pieces of paper to make sure that I would get them separate, I realise I've given them exactly the same rating.
Yeah.
But less than Chronicle for Leibowitz.
Yeah, well,
so that sort of basically took,
you'll have to Leibowitz, tweak it. You'll have to tweak it toward the end of the year to get your best off.
Yeah, maybe that's it, you see, because when you get there at the end and you get there at the end of the year, you can look at that and say, okay, Leibowitz is 4.8. Yeah, okay, that's going to be in the top five. Are these two in the top five? Well, at this particular point in time, almost a quarter of the way through the year, yes, they are.
Mm.
So that basically means I've got three of my top five SF novels already done.
Mm.
What am I going to do about that?
Yeah, we'll see what else you come across.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Okay, then next, this is a little bit of an extended spiel, but I'll try not to make it too long. I was very lucky last year to be given a gift card for some work I did for a choir. I do design work for. I design posters and stuff for them. And so as a gift, as a reward for that, I got a gift card to readings. And one of the books I bought is a beautiful hardcover book, really nice looking cover, called Demon Voices by Philip Pullman. Now, Philip Pullman is the chap who's written, a lot of books, but the ones he's probably most famous for is his Dark Materials trilogy, which I think he now is on a TV series on HBO. And he's also wrote quite a few earlier books, young adult books, which are the Sally Lockhart series, which start with the book The Ruby and the Smoke. Anyway, this book isn't fiction. What this is a book about... it's a series of essays and speeches about writing, and they're beautifully written. I don't know what to say. They're sort of endlessly wise and thought-provoking little pieces, non-fiction pieces. And whether you want to be a writer yourself or not, but even just as a reader, you'd find some of these fascinating. And it's always comforting to me to find a writer that you greatly admire has also read many of the books that you have, and who brings interesting insights into those works. And that's certainly the case here. And Philip Pullman discusses with pleasure and insight both adult books and children's literature, such as the William books by Richmond Crompton, the young adult books, historical books by Leon Garfield, and even the Moomin Troll books by Tove Jansson. Among many others. So it's sort of, he says really nice things and interesting things about all of those works, which some of which I read as a child and some of which I read when I was a bit older, but he has clever things to say. But one of the particularly interesting things I've found in the book is that Pullman, although he's often described as a writer of fantasy, which most people would describe his Dark Materials as fantasy, although I personally would call them science fiction, but never mind. Most people call them fantasy, but he rejects that label, and he refers to his work in his Dark Materials as strict realism. And,
really?
Yes. And he explains what he means by that in reference to works of pure fantasy like The Lord of the Rings. And he suggests that there's more imagination required to create a work like Middlemarch by George Eliot than in The Lord of the Rings. That's obviously a very controversial opinion. But nevertheless, he justifies it pretty well, I think. It's actually quite interesting. He's talking about how it takes a lot of imagination to create things which resonate with people as being real, really real to their lives and have a real sympathy with what their own lives have been like. Whereas a lot of fantasy is, you can just make it up, and so there's not necessarily a lot of actual imagination required to do that. So I can't, without quoting a lot of the book, I can't justify that for him. But I thought he did a pretty good job. So that's a real treasure, that book. I'll come back to it many times. So in the book, he talks about a lot of other works, as I've said. And some of them are the books that he himself has written. And I hadn't read these before, so I actually went out to dig them up and see what I thought about them. And so the first, I'm just going to talk about two of them. The first of these is a book called Clockwork, or All Wound Up. It's a really a very creepy fairy tale. And it starts in this little German town of Glockenheim. And we meet this character called Karl, and he's an apprentice clockmaker. And when we meet him, he's sitting gloomily in a corner of the tavern on the evening before he is due to reveal his masterpiece. That is literally the piece that he has constructed to prove that he has completed his apprenticeship and become a master, which is what the word masterpiece means. Anyway, he's sitting there very gloomily because all apprentices before him create a piece for the magnificent tower clock in the town, and they create an animated piece of clockwork to go on the tower and to come out when the clock strikes the hour. But we find out very quickly that Karl hasn't in fact completed anything for his masterpiece. Nobody knows this except himself. However, as he sits there wondering what the heck he's going to do the next day, this oddly attired stranger sits down beside him and tells him he knows his secret and that can help him by giving him a figure that the stranger's already created, a figure of a knight with a great sword. There is, of course, a price to be paid. And who this stranger is and how he's connected with the health of the young Prince Florian, who lives in the palace, are slowly revealed. Everything connects together and works out like a piece of clockwork. It's creepy, but a really good bit of storytelling. So that was that book. I really enjoyed that. And there's another book I'll mention called I Was a Rat, or The Scarlet Slippers. I Was a Rat. So that starts with this old couple sitting in their little house when there's a desperate knocking on the door. And they're surprised because they don't usually get visitors at this hour of the night. They open the door and they find this desperate, scruffy young boy who's dressed in the uniform of a page boy, which is now rather torn and dirty. And he looks up at them and says, I was a rat. And they're baffled and they take him into the house and they offer him some gruel, a porridge if you like, into which he immediately sticks his nose and starts slurping. He doesn't seem to know how to use a spoon, so they have to teach him how to do it. Anyway, the kindly couple warm to this strange boy whom they name Roger, because he doesn't seem to have a name of his own. And they're unsure what to do with him, so they try to appeal to various authorities, the police, the doctor, the government, but are generally spurned until the royal philosopher general takes an interest in the boy. And this is not at all to the good, as we find out. Meanwhile, the town's all agog because of the upcoming royal wedding of the prince and princess. And this princess has come from some far country, and it appears that she turned up very suddenly, and apparently from nowhere, but she's apparently from this distant country that they know of. So these things all start to connect together very cleverly. But there's also a really lot of really good biting satire in the book about the way that the press works, particularly the modern tabloid press in London, in England, because it's kind of set almost in the contemporary sort of world. So there's all this stuff about how the tabloid press beat up all this endless nonsense, romantic nonsense about the royals and the prince and the princess. But also how they can very quickly stir up hatred and paranoia about someone. Anyway, at length we discover Roger's origins, as well as those of the princess, which seem to be connected. You can probably guess where this is going, but whatever the story is, we find that Roger is telling the truth when he claims, I was a rat. So I thought that was great. A brilliant balance of a modern fairy tale with a very pointed satire of contemporary life. Great stuff. Loved it.
Good. Do you remember me recently discussing with you about my metaphor about how reading is food for the soul?
Yes, indeed.
That there are times when you want a good solid banquet and other times when you just want pizza.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about pizza. Now, this is a book. Well, a lot of people would have heard of this guy. This is number 24 in the series of Jack Reacher novels by Lee Child,
mm-hmm.
Blue Moon, from 2019. Now, these Reacher novels started way back in 1997 with Killing Floor. And the interesting thing about this particular book is that it is probably the last to be written by the author alone. It's since come out that Lee Child has, well, after 24 novels, I think he's a bit sick of it.
Hmm.
And you can almost get that impression in the last couple, where the one last year, 2018, was a bit laboured. I didn't think it was that good. And this one is extremely violent. It really is almost, it almost wallows in it in a lot of ways. And I think that he's basically got to the end of his tether. So what's happened is that, according to some of the interviews that Child has given recently, he had decided that he would probably kill off Reacher in the next book. His publishers, of course, are not very happy about this because the Jack Reacher novels come out each year at the just before Christmas, and they sell motzes, bucket loads of books all over the place. You see people reading them everywhere. I've even heard 78, 80-year-old ladies on the train talking about them. So a lot of A.S. Byatt is a really massive fan of Jack Reacher. She can't believe that this guy can basically put this stuff out and it just flows. It just off it goes. It's great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's happened is that Lee Child's younger brother has actually become a writer as well. And so the next book is going to be co-authored between the two with the idea that Lee Child will gradually step aside and Andrew Child, the brother, these are both pseudonyms, by the way, will then take over. So the Child name will still continue, but it'll be the younger brother writing the books as opposed to the older brother. The older brother will probably just come up with some ideas and just flick some things through to him. Anyway, if you're not aware of what the Jack Reacher novels are, these are a classic series of thrillers. We can have a big discussion as to whether they're crime novels or thrillers, but I don't believe any major... He's not trying to solve a crime here. He's trying to fix a problem that ordinary American people find themselves in. He normally latches himself onto somebody. In this case, he finds that there's an old man on the bus that he's on who's got a large amount of money falling out of his pocket. He realises that somebody else on the bus is looking at him and is going to mug him. So he follows the two of them, stops the mugging, helps the guy home, and then finds out that the guy has been hocking everything that he's got in order to pay his daughter's medical bills. So he says, oh, that doesn't seem very good. I basically should try and help you out with this. But you can't, you know, you can't do this, says the old man. No, no, no. Why not? Nothing else to do. And this is what Reacher is. He's a classic knight errant.
Mm-hmm.
That old medieval style of the knight going off and doing good. Now, this particular book actually has an interview conducted by George Martin, of all people, with Lee Child, in which Lee Child talks about where he got the idea to be able to do this from. And his line was that when he got made redundant from his job, he had to try and do something. He was reading a lot of crime novels, but he was sick to the back teeth of the fact that all the major characters in all the crime novels that he was reading at the time, were men who were damaged in some way or other. They were alcoholic, divorced, depressed, suicidal. He just got sick of the fact that these guys were just so depressing. So he decided to create a character who is like the epitome of good.
Mm-hmm.
Though the only way that he can implement that good is by doing a lot of really bad things. So he basically tries to stop bad things happening to good people. If you remember one of the classic westerns, Shane, mm-hmm. from the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
a rider comes into town, finds there's a problem, cleans it all up, and then leaves at the end of the film. There's no background, there's no beginning, there's no end. He doesn't stay on, there's no connection. He just moves on to the next task that he has to do. And that's the type of thing that these books are about. These are classic pizza novels. Yeah. You can sit down and you can just read them in 2 days and they flow. Mm. This guy's got a really good storytelling talent, although this one really is very, very violent. And so it's probably much more so than the previous novels. So some people, it's probably not a good one to start with. But no, no. I enjoyed it. No. I gave it 3.6.
Oh, very good. Okay, so we've been talking about what we've been reading this year, but we also like to find out what other people, our friends of ours, have been reading and what they recommend and so on. And so Perry interviewed a couple of friends, Lucy Sussex and Perry's friend Chong, and I thought it's appropriate for him to introduce us to those two people, and then we'll go into the interviews we've got with them.
Well, I think people will know who Lucy Sussex is. She's appeared on this podcast now a couple of times, once with an interview about her book Blockbuster, which we ran last year. And then a couple of episodes ago, there was a discussion with Lucy regarding the shelf life of Zora Cross. Lucy's an author, written in both the crime and science fiction and fantasy fields. She's an editor. She has a PhD in literature, and she's a literary scholar and a good friend of the two of ours. And she came up with some very interesting books that I'd never heard of. So that's always a good thing. It was good to hear about more books that you haven't heard of. Our other guest is W.H. Chong. Now, Chong I met through my wife. She knows his partner very well, went to university with him. Chong is an artist, a writer, a blogger. He has a piece in the National Gallery in Canberra. And his probably major claim to fame that a lot of people would know about him for is that he's a book designer for text publishing. If you've ever been into a bookshop in Australia and you've seen the Australian text classics, the yellow background cover and all those covers, they are his. So he is the Chong of W.H. Chong from text publishing. Best books of 2019?
Well, some of them I only read at the beginning of 2019, and they're actually from late 2018, but ones that I thought stood out: Chloe Hooper Arson. I think that's probably the best true crime I read in the year. Its timing perhaps wasn't great, but she took a long time to write it because she had kids, and that there were other factors which slowed the book down, and then it's suddenly become extremely relevant right now, even though she's dealing with what has proved to be something that's not happening this year, which is an arsonist. But it's a downright difficult topic, and the book I compare it to is Adrian Hyland's Kinglake, which moved like a fire or a train, and I'm just comparing the two of them and thinking that it's pretty hard. They're both very good on the science of fire.
Are these both... I know Kinglake's based on the Black Friday fires from the late 2000s, but what about
Churchill and Gippsland?
Oh, okay. So, and when was that?
That was 2009 again.
Okay.
And Brendan Sokolak, who was the arsonist, was actually employed as a gardener at Monash Gippsland. And in that, she's trying to look in that Kinglake is about a cop's experience. And this one is about the two books are like complementary. So the cop's experience, and then the criminals, looking at the criminal in Chloe Hooper's arson and trying to understand arson and the effects of it. So it was pretty strong, but most of everything she does is pretty strong. And I think that, you know, she's as a non-fiction writer, she's probably there's very few who are her equal, in Australia at least. But that said, the other non-fiction I liked, again from late 2018, this is a completely different book. The Wasp and the Orchid by Daniel Claude, who's someone I've met a couple of occasions and who I chat with on Facebook. So statement of conflict of interest alert here.
That's okay.
But it's about, again, as with Zora Cross, a largely forgotten figure, although not so much among scientists. Edith Coleman was a Melbourne naturalist who solved a scientific problem which had, which even Darwin couldn't solve, which was orchid pollination. And so that she observed a native wasp in an orchid. And this is sort of, and realizing how the wasp was being, and the orchid had evolved together so that the orchid attracted the wasp. And Darwin hadn't worked out how orchids pollinated, and okay. she did. So this, she didn't actually have much scientific training. She was, she'd been a teacher, and she stood up before the Field Naturalist Club in Victoria and delivered this mesmerising paper, in which she, I'm Edith Coleman. I'm a housewife, and I've solved a problem that Darwin couldn't solve. Well, not in quite in those terms, but it was one of the more stunning moments in Australian zoology, biology. And so she would publish over 300 articles for Australian Nature. And again, someone has been forgotten. And sort of, it's a lovely produced book from Picador. It's partly also a history of the outer Melbourne suburbs and how bush-like they were. You couldn't do it now. But it's quiet. It's not a book that draws a lot of attention to itself, and that is, I think, actually consistent with Edith Coleman herself. But it's a compeller. And
did it get much notice in the papers and the awards?
Favourable notice, and it has won one award, which I've completely forgotten what it is, but it has won one award. And it's just a really engaging book.
Okay.
So that was probably biography non-fiction that was possibly up there. The other autobiography memoir was Viv Albertine, completely different again. Viv Albertine was a member of the Slits, who were punk band, and contemporaneous with the Sex Pistols. And she previously wrote Volume 1, which was called Clothes, 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 Music, 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 Boys, 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 which summed up her interests at that time. And it was there's been a lot of very good women's rock memoirs. And Albertine just came from nowhere. She hadn't been forgotten, but she was a sort of a presence. And it was an absolutely brilliant bit of memoir. This one is actually more about her family and what an appallingly dysfunctional family was, which continued until her mother's death, and on her mother's deathbed, and with a really brutal expose of the sibling rivalry. And my God, it was visceral. It was a very, very powerful book. And if I could think of the antithesis of Daniel Claude books, it would be this one. But a really fascinating read, even if you're not, say, a great fan of the Slits as a band. As for fiction, the trouble is I get interested in writers who then turn out to be very hard to get hold of because I have weird tastes. A lot of the stuff I'm into, I like when I can follow an author and keep reading. So Mavis Cheek, who's an English writer, reviewed a book she wrote about Anne of Cleves years ago, and I thought, blimey, that's an interesting writer, but because I was reviewing so much, didn't follow it up, and then happened to be in Edinburgh, and there was a second-hand bookstall for aid of the Scottish charities. So picked up this one, Patrick Parker's Progress. The thing about Mavis Cheek, she's very much in the satirical, light satire, apparent humour but with very sharp claws, this very catty English writing, which is part of the Jane Austen tradition. Barbara Pym is part of this too. She's really, really subversive. So I'd say that, you know, she sort of subtly undermines the patriarchy. This one is all about bridge building. And bridge building as a, and part of it sends up Isambard Kingdom Brunel and a young man who intends to be the equivalent of Brunel as it becomes a particularly vain and showy architect. And so she's undercutting him right through the book. And it's the story of a woman who is discarded, Audrey, who's discarded by Patrick and decides to take a very long delayed but quite satisfactory revenge. I mean, there's a bit in this book which I think is rather dodgy, but my God, it's an enjoyable performance. And, you know, chiefly, you know, I don't know any Mavis Cheek fans, but my God, she's an enjoyable writer. Ditto Jo Walton, who's an English, now Canadian writer, wrote very well about Wales. And again, probably well best known.
Is this W-H or W-A-L-E-S? Wales is in the state or Wales is in the...
Wales is in the nation.
As in the nation, right, yeah. Okay. Sorry, I just want to make sure.
Yeah. So she's an interesting in a different way. She moves around a bit. So I was reading her Farthing Trilogy, which is an alternative English Nazi. And, well, this has been done before, even before Second World War. You had Catherine Burdekin's Swastika Night, which was an analysis of how the Nazi regime would lose, which is like The Handmaid's Tale with Nazis, but it's a precursor of The Handmaid's Tale. And it's very, very, very powerful. Jo Walton is actually looking at the creeping Nazification of England and what would happen if they'd taken over, and drawing on the Duke of Windsor and his Nazi sympathies. And it's very, very convincing, I think. And reading this parallel to the Brexit events, you're thinking, yes, there's this vein in Britain which surfaces now and then. So basically, she takes the basis of the Mitford sisters. So she has a sister of family of sisters and their adventures. So there's half a crown and there's farthing and then there's it's three books, and they're it's one of these things that, and I suppose the other one is A Man in the High Castle, but this is the British version. And it's, you know, she knows exactly what she's doing. You know, you're reading this, you think this writer knows how to plot, knows how to do character. She's got it all there. So that was one of the pleasures. The other one was, I would say, again, a writer I've only recently come across and I'd known about for years, was Liz Hand, which was Generation Loss. Now, she writes about Maine, and as in the state. She lives there, and Generation Loss is about a photographer who's been part of, again, the punk era in New York, and has got fascinated with, gained lots of reputation for photographing dead things. And so she's got an assignment to go and interview another photographer when she's pretty much washed up, and she's got a lot of junky bad habits. And what she comes across is a mystery, teenager goes missing, and it's a not very likable detective, but with an incredible creepy background, and it just gets creepier and creepier as it gets off. So it's crime, mystery, horror. It's also about the history of photography, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is a writer I've definitely got to follow. And then I find that she's bloody hard to find around the place. This is my bad luck. But I'm going to finish up with saying that, well, because I'm writing a biography, I can't read systematically. I read as a kind of, you know, relief from the biography. So Disha Peace came out at the end of this year, and that's a different... He's got various series. And this one is interesting because it's following on from the Clear Valley, which is part of South Australia I much like. and its absolute sense of place. And it's continuing the adventures of his semi-disgraced cop and his relationships
This is the sequel to Bitter Wash Road.
Which I thought was actually possibly his best novel.
Oh, okay. You know, I must admit, I did really enjoy that when I read it. And I've got Peace on the in the dining room, or in the lounge room, staring at me every time I walk past it, saying, read me, but I have to do that, yeah?
Yeah, well, he's not the most showy of Australian writers in that, you know, Temple, there's more showiness on show. He's quieter about his art, but he ties things very acutely together, and he's great on place.
He's got a bloody incredible backlist too, hasn't he? He's got a lot, and he's got a lot of good stuff in there. His Wyatt series and his Peninsula Murder series, just to name two.
Yeah, all he needs is, you know, a TV series or three.
Well, there should be.
Yeah, there should be. I reckon South Australian Film Corp goes up to the Clare Valley, starts filming Bitter Wash Road, and they've got a sequel on their own. Yeah, you know, nice to learn it.
I would have thought so.
But Peace, interestingly, was partly done as a thesis at La Trobe Uni because he basically took the track of, well, as so many Australian writers do, well, I need to work. I need a bit of money and I need to work on something, and I'd be nice to have a sympathetic editor, you know, a nice supervisor who will pick out my errors. So he's gone that road, and there's been quite a lot of books that have been produced these days by established writers who've gone back to uni and found a really fruitful relationship. And so this one came out of La Trobe Uni. And so when I went to the launch of this, there was the supervisor.
Okay.
Sitting in the audience and clapping.
As they would.
Indeed, because he's completed, so that's extra points for them.
Oh, good. So it's good all the way around. Now, Dish is right up there in the major Australian crime novels. He doesn't get the big flashy notices that, the Jane Harpers and the Catherine Foxes get, but he's up there, and he's one of the better ones of the whole lot.
I'm interested to see what goes with his promotion right now, because I think that there's a gap, and I think he can possibly, you know, if we're going to talk horses, you know, he's going to sort of...
Down the outside and stream into the straight.
Yeah, something,
Do a Kiwi and come from the back of the field and just win the Melbourne Cup.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's not at the back of the field, he's in the middle, and he's basically moving ahead now.
So it's a gap. And that ties in neatly with Peace being partly about horses, but I won't tell you because you haven't read the book.
No, I will. No, don't spoil it for me. All right, well, thanks very much for that. There's some good books there, some fantastic stuff. Thank you. And here we have Chong talking quickly about some of the books that he liked that he read in 2019.
Last year, I read a bunch of SF stuff, which I really didn't get into or enjoy. For example, Marlon James' Black Leopard, Red Wolf, Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Moon, and I love Kim Stanley Robinson. I found it slightly tedious. I read Max Porter's Lanny because everyone's raving about it. At the same time, I read Grief is the Thing with Feathers Too, and I just found it irritating. I read Best SF of the Year from Clark. I tried reading Blackfish City, which didn't take. All the stuff, I put it aside in the end. The ones I actually did like in genre space were Liu Xixin's Wandering Earth collection. I read the title story to watch the film with. The film is amazing. Quite something. Because of the old-fashioned hard SF ambition. Okay. It's very rare to see that stuff now, I think.
Yes.
And I read On the Beach.
Oh, okay.
Which was written in 1957. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Okay.
I was really surprised. And it's really quite moving. And even though some of the gender dynamics are old-fashioned, it stands up very well. But they weren't really my favorite books. They just happened to be my favorite genre reading. My favorite books happened to be odd things like Alexander Chee's How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, Korean-American, And then read Eric Larson's In the Garden of Beasts, which is subtitled Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. We were going to Berlin. It's a really good book. One of the stunning things is how the Americans just really, really didn't believe that Hitler was an issue.
Yeah.
And this guy was the U.S. ambassador, and he didn't believe it when he arrived. And he, when he finally, the penny dropped, he couldn't get anyone in Washington to believe him. Really amazing book. But here are two recommendations for this year. I have just read William Gibson's Agency. I think that's terrific if you like Gibson. If you don't like Gibson, you're going to hate it. And the one to watch out for, I think it comes out in June this year, is Robbie Arnott's The Rain Heron. Robbie Arnott is a young Tassie writer. A couple of years ago, he came out with Flames. The Rain Heron, which is set in an unnamed country, is one of the most affecting kind of parables of the climate future. It's fabulous.
Okay.
I read it manuscript. It's got a fabulous cover too.
Oh. Designed by?
Me.
Well, that's always a good recommendation if you actually like and do a good cover for it.
Well, when you're excited by a book, yeah, you invest more time because you just, you know, you just want to do something good for it.
All right, thanks, Perry. I think it's been an interesting and full episode, and we'll meet again over the airwaves in another couple of weeks.
Yes, we have a number of things planned. Always got lots of plans now, just a matter of finding the time. But we won't be able to necessarily get out and speak to people face-to-face, David.
No,
we're going to have to do it over the webs like we are doing it here.
That's right.
But that's okay. We have the technology. We can do this.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, keep well, everyone who's listening, and we'll do the best to keep ourselves well too. So we'll catch you next time.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Perry. Bye.